Nu e shulen herian he von riches wert. Me tores michte ant his modje thonk. We ok wolde fader, swa he wundre je was e che drichten ort on stalde. He ares je shop, erden bernum, he von de rove, hali schippend, tha miden yard, mon kunas wert, e che drichten after theode, firum folden, freya allmichtig. So that's a sample of West Saxon Old English. That's the language I'm going to be introducing you today. If it sounds like gibberish, don't worry. Probably still will after two lectures and a couple of tutorials, but hopefully at least you'll be able to get an idea of the structure behind what's going on here. So this is Cædmon's hymn. It's a very particular text. This text is written, it's a poem written supposedly by a monk called Cædmon. Cædmon was what's called a lay brother. He worked at the monastery. He was responsible for looking after the animals at a monastery. And it became known, it became apparent after a while, that he had a real talent for writing poetry and songs. This is what he wrote. It's a little song of praise. We'll be looking at it a little bit more later on when we talk about how the language is pronounced. Because today, we're going to do some of the features of Old English that you will need to know. We're going to spend 2 weeks on Old English because it's quite challenging. We're going to start today with talking about the sources for Old English. So how do we know about Old English at all? What evidence do we have for this language? What kind of texts are written in this language? We're going to talk about the spelling systems. We're going to talk about sounds, so how the language is pronounced. We're going to talk about the morphology in quite some detail as well, because the morphology of Old English is probably the place where it differs the most from present-day English. So in both the nominal and the verbal domains, there are quite some differences between Old English and the present-day language. And remember that the period we're dealing with is this period at 450 to 1150. So we're talking about a very long period, which also should give you some concern, should raise some questions in your head, because remember, no language exists statically in a vacuum. Languages, in the usual sense, are always changing. And when we talk about Old English, we're talking about 700 years and an entire area, an entire country, the whole of the British Isles. So you might imagine that there would be some variation, and there is, although less than one might think, and there are reasons for that too. And we're going to come back to that more next week when we talk about some of the dialectal variants. Just a reminder of the tutorials. You have the tutorial times on the slides. You have the tutors' names on the slides. Feel free to show up and be tutored. And one thing to note, if you find yourself currently in a tutorial that is oversubscribed, that you feel is too full, do feel free to move to one that is less full if you would prefer, because we've got plenty of tutorials, plenty of capacity, so it shouldn't be a problem if you need to move around. Maybe contact your tutor if you're unsure about that. We covered the history of the early part of the British Isles before. What we said was that in the first half of the 5th century, we get these Germanic-speaking peoples, the Angles, the Saxons, the Frisians, and the Jutes, coming to England and settling there. And what we witness then is de facto the birth of a new language, Old English as a separate language, spoken by these Germanic peoples, often called tribes. Now, the earliest Old English was written in runes. And again, last week we talked about the Old English, we talked about the Futhark, the Elder Futhark runic alphabet. The Old English people wrote in something called the Futhor, which is a descendant of the Futhark alphabet. It's very, very similar, with only a few minor differences. We're not going to focus on that today at all, because by the time we get longer texts written in Old English, they're all written using the Latin alphabet. But the early Old English runic writings are very interesting in their own right. And if you're interested in reading more about them, you might want to look at this book by Page 1999. Also, I should say at this point, anything that is cited on the slides, I'm trying to make available in the semester apparat for this course. So you can go to the library and look for that there. There's also a link on Ilias that takes you, shows you what's in there. So hopefully that will be a useful resource for looking things up if you want to follow up on any of the references. And obviously, I'm not expecting you to follow up on all of them, but there might be some points where you're interested, you want to take it further, and then you can go and do a little bit of extra reading around that. So what about the sources, then, and the spelling for this language? Starting out with the sources, this is one of the manuscripts. This is a really beautiful piece of work. This is a manuscript called the Lindisfarne Gospels. If you look at it, what you see is actually this is a text that was written originally in Latin. It's a version of the Gospels in Latin. Although it's not very exciting in terms of what it says, because we've got lots of copies of the Gospels in Latin. And this one, it just happens to be very beautifully done, so it's a very artistic piece of work. What actually really interests us from the perspective of Old English, of historical linguistics of English, is that a monk named Aldred in the 10th century decided to add some glosses to this text. Basically, he was doing a sort of highly high-register version of scribbling in the margins. And above the Latin letters, above the Latin words, you find Old English words. So the big sort of curly words that are in red text here are the Latin words, and above them there's some little scribbles, which are the Old English bits, which are the part that really is interesting for us. And this is a very special text, because it's written in Northumbrian Old English, from the very north of England. And we don't have all that many texts at all that are like that. So this is just one of the many beautiful sources that we have. When we talk about the sources, we, on the whole, have to distinguish between two periods. We have to talk about the early Old English period, which is before 900, and the late Old English period, which is after it. Early Old English, in particular, is associated with King Alfred, who is one of the founding figures of the British national myth. Interestingly, King Alfred came 15th in a survey of the greatest Britons of all time in the UK recently. And this is quite striking, because King Alfred himself would not have actually viewed himself as a Briton at all, quite the opposite. He was an Anglo-Saxon. There were Britons too, but they were Celtic speakers. So this term Briton has come in much later to be used specifically for this term Briton, to use to anyone who lives in the British Isles, came in later. That's what I wanted to say. Alfred of Wessex, he was the King of Wessex. From a socio-historical perspective, he's important because he was the person who was in charge of Wessex at the time that the Vikings were raiding, or Viking, as it were, because the term Viking really refers not to a people or an ethnic group, though it's often used that way, but rather to an activity, to go Viking, which was a particular kind of raiding overseas. King Alfred was the sort of the first line of defense of the Anglo-Saxons against these people. And if you remember before, when we talked about when the Anglo-Saxons arrived and they conquered the country, you might think that turnabout is fair play, and that the fact that then the Vikings come along and try and attack it in their turn is kind of only fair. Nevertheless, obviously the Anglo-Saxons didn't particularly want to be attacked. So they defended themselves, and King Alfred was the person who was leading that defense. Sometimes by paying off the Vikings, sometimes by fighting off the Vikings, different strategies. The aim was the same, to keep them out. And ultimately, in that respect, they failed pretty badly, because more than half of England ended up under Viking rule. In fact, by the time of the 11th century, the entire country ends up under what's sometimes called Viking rule, at least Scandinavian rule. In terms of the period we're interested in, King Alfred is particularly important because what he did was to say we should be writing more texts in our native language and not in Latin. And that was an important contribution, because before that, there were texts written in the British Isles, but pretty much exclusively in Latin. That was the written language. There was no vernacular writing tradition. And with King Alfred, that changed, and we had this very productive period of writing in the early Old English language. So that's the early Old English period. Late Old English is Old English after 900, and this is particularly associated with another monastic figure, the Abbot Alfred of Angem, who was active from alive 955 to 1010 approximately, and he was the single most prolific writer of the period. So he wrote all kinds of things. Perhaps his best-known works are a series of saints' lives. He wrote down the lives, the stories of different saints and the miracles that they performed, and mostly the ways in which they ended up being brutally killed, because there's no better way to become a saint in the early Catholic Church than to be brutally killed by people who don't appreciate you. In terms of how much Old English we have, we've got about 3 million words in total. So that's over all of the periods, over all of the texts, we have about 3 million words. That's really not that much when you think about it. A novel may be something like 80,000 to 100,000 words, and even if you take the whole of Old English put together, we ultimately just don't have that much material compared to, I mean, if you think about people on Twitter, how long it takes them to collectively type 3 million words, it's really not very long. Probably that happens roughly every 10 seconds these days. So it's really quite striking that we have so little Old English. But we don't have complete cause for despair, because in other respects we're actually doing pretty well as far as Old English is concerned. Certainly when we look at other languages of the same period, like Old High German, or Old Saxon, or Gothic, or even Old Norse from the same period, the Scandinavian language of the same period, we don't find nearly as much. Old English is by far the best attested language from this period among the Germanic languages. And that, I think, is largely due to King Alfred and the vernacular writing reforms that he introduced. Okay, so what do we have in Old English then? In terms of the major works, the one that really stands out from a literary perspective is Beowulf. You might have heard of Beowulf already. It's been made into various films. It's been translated many, many times. It's essentially the story of an adventuring hero, his exploits in monster slaying, his exploits politically. It's a good story, ultimately. It's quite a lot of fun. The thing that's not so fun with Beowulf is trying to read it in the original, because it's a very, very difficult text to read for all kinds of reasons. It's a mixed dialect, so it's Northumbrian and West Saxon. It's got bits of both because of the way that the manuscripts were transmitted, probably. The manuscript itself comes from around the year 1000. We can be fairly sure about that. What we can't be quite sure about is when Beowulf itself was actually written. Some people push for a date as early as the 7th century. Others would say, no, it was written roughly at the time that the manuscript was written. So this is the first time it was composed in writing. And so there is a debate here. People argue about when this text was written. Linguistically, what we can certainly say is it seems very archaic. It seems to have features that are associated with the very earliest Old English. But of all of the Old English texts, this is the one that's attracted the most interest for its content, because it preserves something, although it contains elements of Christian theology, it also preserves lots of elements of a presumed earlier Germanic way of life, and also a Germanic way of writing epic narrative and epic verse. That's why this text has got such great interest from a literary perspective. We also have the Lindisfarne Gospels, which is the text that you saw before. If I just scroll back, it's this one that you can see on the slide. And this is an interlinear gloss. So it's a very, very word-for-word translation, in a sense, of the Bible, of the Gospels of the Bible, into Old English, into Northumbrian Old English. We have various other manuscripts. So in terms of the poetry, we have, for instance, the Junius manuscript, And the texts contained in this manuscript are also of various dates, of various types. There's an Old English version of the Genesis, an Exodus, a text called Christ and Satan. The Exeter book is another big poetry text. It contains other things such as riddles. Now, the Old English riddles are some of the most entertaining Old English texts because they're very, very short, and obviously they invite you to solve them. And if you go looking for riddles, there's a very nice blog called The Riddle Ages, where you can find out more about the Old English riddles and try your hand at solving one or two of them yourself. What's interesting about the riddles, really, is that they show how the people who were writing the texts would perhaps have let off steam, because these riddles are usually not particularly religious in nature. They're sometimes a little bit scurrilous or silly, and they are very short, unlike a lot of the other very long texts that these monks were working on. When we think about these texts, these monks who were sitting in their rooms all day writing, we might think of this as a kind of recreational activity for them to play around with these riddles. So that's why they're interesting. And then there's a poem in the Exeter book as well, one very famous poem, very rather difficult to interpret poem called Wulf and Eadwater. That also has gained some literary interest, though it's not nearly as long as a text like Beowulf, say. That's one of the reasons it's so mysterious. We also have texts like the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle. And the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle is basically a big long list of things that happened, listed by year. So if you look at the Chronicle, what you find is it gives you a year and it says, in this year, various things happened. Maybe an abbot died, maybe some Vikings came along. These are things that the Chronicle talks about quite a lot. Every now and then, it talks about other things too. So there is a dragon that appears in the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle. It says, in this year, there was a dragon flying around the sky, fiery dragon. People have speculated, I think, that that was related to a comet that passed by the Earth at around the period, which would be interesting if it was true. But this Anglo-Saxon Chronicle text is not very interesting at all from a literary perspective, but from a historical perspective, it's extremely interesting because essentially, they're just telling you what happened. Of course, it's never that simple. They're telling you what happened from the perspective of the church, of the monasteries, and furthermore, from the perspective of the monasteries that would also have been under the thumb of, protected by, to some extent, maybe funded by, the royal houses of the Anglo-Saxons. So, for instance, the Wessex royal house. So, they can't be taken as an unbiased source, but nevertheless, they're a very good source for the history of England. And there are many other texts, like charters and legal texts, that can help us piece together what was actually happening in this period. So here is just a visual representation of what some of these manuscripts might have looked like. At the top left, we've got the famous first page of Beowulf, which crops up on the lecture slide, the beginning of the lectures every week, Hwat. On the right, we've got this Lindisfarne Gospels, which I showed you earlier on. So beautiful, illuminated Latin manuscript. We've also got things like the Junius manuscript, which contains some interesting illustrations as well as text. Down here we've got the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, very neatly scribbled. And at the bottom left we've got the Exeter book, a text from the Exeter book. So these are some of the major works of the Old English period. Does anyone have any questions or comments at this stage? When it comes to the spelling, the way that the language was actually written down, it uses basically the Roman alphabet. Like I said, there were early texts that were runic, and occasionally runes crop up later on as well. But for the most part, what we find is a modified version of the Roman alphabet. And the specific version of the script that they used is something called the Insula Minuscule. And this is a script that was actually invented in Ireland. So it's an Irish script in origin because the traditions of writing there go back a long way, and this was what was used all over the British Isles as their default way of writing things down. It developed from an earlier script, the Uncial. It's not quite the Latin alphabet as we recognize it today. So if you look at this text here, there are some letters that we don't see today. So, for instance, the ash symbol. This is an A and an E written together, a ligated digraph, it's called. Here we can see a capital one, for instance. It's pronounced A, essentially. Or maybe a little bit higher in front, so something like A. But that's the ash symbol. It's simply what it looks like. It's an A and an E written together. And they wanted a separate symbol for that in the Old English orthography system, presumably to distinguish it from the back vowel A, which is also attested in the language. We also find a letter that is called thorn. So at the beginning of the second line, we can see a thorn. And the thorn looks a bit like a big P with a stick going up and a stick going down. So it's like a merger of a P and a B together in this particular type of script. And you'll see many of those. And there's also a symbol called an ev, which is a D, a curly D with a bar through it. That you can see here. And these symbols, the thorn and the ev, are used more or less interchangeably for the same sounds. And those are the sounds th or th, the interdental fricatives. Now, these are not... the symbols are used more or less interchangeably. The sounds are not. I'll get back to what differentiates which of these sounds was used when we start talking about the sound system in more detail. But these three symbols in particular, when you read scholarly editions of Old English texts, these are preserved there because they're important. You actually need the ash and the thorn and the eth to distinguish what people are saying. The other symbols that I'm going to tell you about now are not found in, they're found in the manuscripts, but for the most part not in the editions. So we have something called a yog, which is basically a different way of writing, it's basically the Old English way of writing a G. Yog develops a life of its own in the Middle English period, but we'll get to that. In the Old English period, it's just a kind of G. Actually, it mostly stood for a y sound, a glide, y. So that's the yog. There's also the win, and a win looks like a sort of a P with an elongated body. So the win, we can see one there, a little one, and there's one up here as well in the first word, this second letter here, that's also a win. So this is the word what, and this is a w. The win stands for w. And there are also different symbols for and. So there is for the word and. These are actually logographic symbols in an otherwise alphabetic system, if you remember our typology of writing systems from last time. This one is called the Tyronean et, and it looks, in the manuscripts, it often looks a bit like a seven. So this just means and we also find the classic ampersand that we still use today. So both of these symbols just mean and. Among these symbols, some of them have different origins. So I've already talked about ash. Ash comes quite straightforwardly from an A and an E written together. We don't need to speculate about the origin of that symbol because it's obvious where it came from. Similarly, the ev, it's kind of obvious where the ev came from, right? The ev is just a D with a bar through the top. And so we can say, well, it probably originated as a D with a bar through the top. That's not rocket science, right? So these are... Ev, interestingly, isn't found in the earliest texts. It comes in later on. But both of them come from, essentially, they're just modified versions of letters that you have anyway in the Roman alphabet. And broadly speaking, the same is true of yog. It's just the way that the letter G was written in this particular type of script. It's not really even a separate character from... it's not a separate character from G. That changes, like I say, in the Middle English period, but we'll get to that. These two and symbols, so the Tyronean et and the ampersand, these go back to the actual earlier Latin scripts from which the insular minuscule itself developed, like the uncial, and these scripts originally would have used the same symbols for the Latin word et, meaning and. These are all fairly straightforward. The ones that are slightly more interesting are thorn and win. And thorn and win actually come from the runic Futhorc alphabet. They're originally runes. They're just runes that were incorporated into the alphabet when people were writing English. Now, you might wonder why. Why would you change an alphabet? Well, one reason that I've already touched upon is you might feel that your alphabet is not sufficient for representing the sounds of the language that you're trying to write. And that's that would be why, for instance, you might introduce a special ash symbol, an A and an E written together, this ligature, rather than writing out a whole, rather than using the same symbol as for an existing letter. And the same with thorn and win. Latin itself didn't use this th sound, and it didn't, as for the were, the typical way of writing this in other languages that use the Latin alphabet is to simply write two U's together. And this is the sound, what eventually became the W that we have today in our alphabet. But it's actually, in a way, somewhat neater to use this win rune, a completely separate symbol that comes from the runic alphabet. But the only two that come from the runic alphabet are these two, thorn and win. The others are all developments, native developments, within the Latin alphabet, the Roman alphabet. So that's the writing system. Now we're going to talk about the sound system. We're going to talk about the sounds of Old English and also a little bit how they changed. And I hopefully shouldn't need to remind you now that it's that sounds and spelling are not the same thing. Right? Spelling is one way of representing sounds. And when we talk about the sounds of Old English, we should be very careful not to confuse it with the spelling of Old English. So here we can see the basic setup for Old English sounds. At the top, we've got the vowels. These are the vowels that you have in Old English. On the bottom, you've got the consonants. Starting with the vowels, it's worth saying that each vowel has a short version and a long version. That is, there was a length distinction that was phonemic in Old English. It actually made a meaning difference whether you used a longer vowel or a short vowel. This is not represented in the manuscripts themselves, but it is something that it's important to bear in mind, especially when you're trying to pronounce the language. So we had this short versus long vowel distinction that was phonemic. And if you don't know what I mean when I say phonemic, then you should really go and look that up, because that's going to be important throughout the course. Okay. Not all sounds occur in all positions, and this is typical of languages in general. We don't find every single possible sound in every single possible phonological environment. So, for instance, fricatives, that's this column here, the f, th, s, sh, h, h. These sounds are they're only voiced between voiced sounds. So you only find voiced fricatives in voiced contexts. That is, voicing in fricatives was an allophonic distinction. It was not a phonemic distinction. There are no minimal pairs. There are no words that are distinguished only by the fact that they have either a voiced fricative or a voiceless fricative in a certain position. That means that we're dealing with phonemically non-distinct sounds here. The voiced versions were allophones. They were simply pronunciation variants of the same sound. What this indicates, essentially, is that the Anglo-Saxons didn't perceive the voiced and the voiceless versions of fricatives as different sounds, basically. That's what it means to be only allophones rather than phonemically distinct. Similarly, there is an ng sound. This is a velar nasal. This ng sound in Old English is only found before a k or a g. And this is more or less still true today. Right? So if we say a word like ink, if you think about how you pronounce that, if you just stop it before the last consonant, you're actually making an ng most of the time rather than a pure nasal n. It's an ng at the back of the mouth, a velar nasal. So that's only found before a k and a g in Old English. Otherwise, as far as the vowels are concerned, I should also say there are diphthongs. And the diphthongs are sequences of, basically they involve a transition, an articulatory transition from one position in the mouth to the other. So there's, for instance, an air diphthong, which involves starting out higher in the mouth and moving down in the mouth as you're pronouncing the diphthong. And like the short, like the vowels, diphthongs can both be short and long. So the diphthongs might be either short or long, and this is phonemically distinct. Otherwise, there are no sounds that are likely to cause you any great actual pronunciation difficulty in Old English. These are the sounds that we have, and mostly they are, by and large, the same sounds that we have in present-day English, with the exception, perhaps, of these guys down here. These are velar fricatives, so these are sounds like h or r, and at least the velar h is something that you have in German as well. So in a word like nach, you would have a velar fricative there. That's what the system of sounds of Old English looks like. Of course, we're dealing with a 700-year period, so it doesn't always stay that way. The system of sounds in Old English does not stay the same throughout the whole period. So we're going to talk about three different types of change in detail today, and those are palatalization, breaking, and vowel fronting, what's known as I-umlaut. These aren't the only things that happen, but we've only got a limited amount of time and only a limited amount of brain capacity for this kind of thing, so we can leave the others aside. But for instance, you have examples of things like metathesis. This is a nice case. So hros, the early word hros, changes into horse. So the O and the R actually swap places in the word. This is a change that did not happen in German. So the word that is directly related to horse in German is Ross. And in what happened in German was that the H was lost at the beginning of the word. So originally it would have been something like Ross. But then that H was lost, and so in German it became Ross. In English, on the other hand, the O and the R swapped places, so it became horse. And that is more or less how it has stayed up until the present day. But today, we're going to focus on the big three of palatalization, breaking, and vowel fronting. So palatalization is the most complicated of the three, because with palatalization, you don't quite know always what's going to happen. So in palatalization, the sounds sk, k, and g are fronted, so that the articulation moves towards the front of the mouth. They're fronted to sh, ch, and y in certain environments. Specifically, when they're followed by certain kinds of vowels, a high vowel, mostly. If you're followed by I, E, A, or the glide y, then those particular consonants will become fronted. They'll become sh, ch, and y. That also happens at the very end of a word after these same sounds. So sk will become sh, as in, for instance, the Old English word ship. It's spelled sc because that's how you spell this particular sound. The sound sh, this one, is written sc. But this is ship, which has been again transferred directly straight. It's survived straight into modern English as ship. Now, if you look at other languages, other Germanic languages, they didn't undergo this change. So in Scandinavian languages, we see the word skip here for a ship. So and a skip has not undergone this palatalization process. Similarly, k, the k sound, written usually as a c in the Old English manuscripts, becomes a ch sound. So this is what's called an affricate. This sound that's a bit like sneezing, ch or j, that is an affricate, and that's what we find in Old English ditch, which again survives into modern English as ditch. And this doesn't happen in all languages. The weirdest one, perhaps, is that the g sound becomes a y sound. And this g sound is written usually as a g. In the Old English texts, it's usually still written as a g, But we know it must have been pronounced as a year. And in the modern English language, it's spelled like this. So, for instance, the word yelwa in Old English, yelwa, is modern English yellow. You can see the connection, but you can hopefully also see the connection to German gelb, right? And in German, this palatalization did not take place. So the g at the beginning of the word did not become a y. If it did, you might have yelp, and the connection to yellow might be a bit clearer. What's interesting about this is that there are borrowings from the Scandinavian languages, Norse borrowings, that come into the language at a later period, so they come into the language during the Middle English period, and aren't affected by this palatalization, because the palatalization has already happened by this point. So, for instance, the word, in Old English, there was the word skirt, which referred to an item of clothing. And that underwent palatalization because of the vowel. And it became shirt. But then, in the Middle English period, the word shirt, which existed also in the Scandinavian languages, was borrowed back into English, but with a slightly different meaning. Both a shirt and a skirt exist in the present-day language. They're cognates, they're related words, but skirt and shirt refer to different items of clothing. And that's what's changed here. Actually, the meaning has changed. The difference is, shirt is the original inherited Old English word that has undergone palatalization, and skirt is the borrowed word that's borrowed later in the Middle English period that actually hasn't undergone palatalization. Similarly, the word egg. So the word egg in English actually originally did undergo palatalization. So in Old English, the word for egg would have been ei, right? Which is like German ei. So in fact, the old English word did undergo palatalization, but then the Norse word came in, and for whatever reason, the Norse word got borrowed to replace ei. So the word egg got essentially borrowed back into the English language from the Scandinavian languages spoken by those particular incomers. Palatalization is not something that only happens in English, so it's actually a very common change cross-linguistically. We see it in German words like Schiff. At an earlier stage, this would have been something like Skiff, but later on it became Schiff. But the German change is different from the English one, because in German, Sk becomes Sch in all positions. Whereas in English, it only becomes sh in certain positions. So this is a different kind of palatalization in German from the one that happens in Old English. It's just that the change as a whole is something that is a very common one cross-linguistically. Now, the tricky thing about palatalization, the thing that really trips people up with palatalization is that West Saxon Old English actually has it. So the Old English texts that we have, at least the West Saxon ones, definitely have palatalization. They just don't represent it in their spelling. So when we look at most editions do not represent this in the spelling. Sometimes they do. Sometimes the texts have a little dot over the C or a dot over the G, and that means that there's palatalization. So you should pronounce it as a sh rather than a sk, or as a y rather than a g. But the editions are not consistent in this, and the manuscripts never represent this palatalization process. Okay, so that's palatalization. Another change that's worth talking about is breaking. So breaking is a change that happens. Palatalization is a change that happens to consonants. Breaking, the second of our three changes, is one that happens to vowels. So the front vowels, I, E, and A, become diphthongs before certain consonants. So for instance, the environments where this happens specifically are before a L or a R, which is followed by a consonant. So in the word self, the English word self, the earlier word self, would have become seolf because of this diphthongization process, this breaking process. It's called breaking because one vowel is breaking in half, essentially. It's breaking into two vowels. This also happens before h or before w. So, for instance, so I becomes iu, which later becomes eo. E becomes eo. So, for instance, in the Old English word werk, for work. This would earlier on have been something like Werk, German Werk, and it changed into Werk because of this process of breaking. And then the A sound, the Ash sound, that corresponds to the Ash symbol, gets broken and becomes Er. And this is true in words like Old English Erld, old, and Herlf, half. So basically breaking causes diphthongs to arise when certain consonants are around. It's a vowel change that creates new diphthongs. And it probably took place in the 7th century, because we do have some texts that predate it, which don't seem to represent the breaking in their spelling, which might suggest that it wasn't actually there. And breaking particularly took place in the south. Now, interestingly, breaking is not a change that survived into present-day English. Often there were later sound changes that took place that undid the effects of breaking. But in the Old English period, you had these diphthongs before L and R in particular. That was the context, the major context for diphthongization arising, for breaking arising. So we've done one consonant change and one vowel change, and then there's one more vowel change to talk about. This one doesn't create diphthongs. It moves the vowels around in the mouth. What it does is it makes back vowels, or low vowels, become fronted before an E. Or a y in the following syllable. And so when you look at, when I talk about low and back vowels, I'm talking in terms of this vowel quadrilateral here that we had on the earlier slide. These are low vowels because they're at the bottom. They're produced low in the mouth. These are back vowels because they're produced at the back of the mouth. Hopefully that's clear. So our back vowels are oo, o, and a, and our low vowels are a and a. It's the low and the back vowels that are affected by fronting, and they're affected in ways that make them more front, basically. So the oo sound, the back oo sound, becomes u, becomes a front vowel. And so, for instance, in the plural of the word mouse, originally the singular of this word would have been moose, mouse, right? And the plural would have been moosey, with an E on the end. And the E causes, because it's in the following syllable, it causes the U to become fronted. So then that would change into moosey, moosey. And then you get a contrast between the singular and the plural in terms of umlaut. And that is ultimately what gives rise to alternations between, to alternations such as mouse versus mice in the present-day language. It's this umlaut process that has gone on, this process of fronting and rounding, well, it was rounded anyway, that causes this to happen. Similarly, goose versus geese. This is exactly the same thing where the plural is formed. Originally, this would have been goose for a goose and goosey for multiple goose, plural goose. And that then became goose, geese, because you front the vowel if there is an E in the following syllable. So that's where the contrast arises, goose, geese, and that then becomes, later in the language, it becomes goose, geese. Similarly, there are other alternations like fall and fell in the present-day language that are also triggered by this umlaut process. What obviously happens, is that the E itself ends up disappearing. For instance, in the modern word mice, we don't talk about micey or geesey. The E itself has been lost through a later phonological change. And there are many, many examples of alternations that are caused by umlaut. So, for instance, man versus men. This also comes from umlaut. Long versus length, right? Or versus e in the vowel. That's caused by this umlaut. Food versus feed. Often there are these causative alternations. So a tree can fall, but a person will fell a tree. You eat food, but if you cause someone to eat food, then you feed them. So these are how these alternations arise. The causative alternations, there are loads. So drank versus drench. Blood versus bleed. So to cause someone to emit blood, again, causative, and hole versus heel. to cause someone to be whole is to heal them. So these alternations come from umlaut, come from what's called I umlaut specifically. I umlaut, you will also see it in the textbooks described as I mutation. So I umlaut, I mutation, same thing. Now, other Germanic languages have I umlaut. In fact, all of them do, all of the ones that have survived. But the interesting thing is the conditions are subtly different on umlaut between the languages. And that has led linguists to argue about whether the umlaut change happened before the Northwest Germanic languages split off from one another, or rather whether the change happened later, but kind of spread a bit like an illness through the populations. There is quite an extensive debate on this that we will not be going into as part of this course. All you need to know is that when you see alternations like in English, we've got goose, geese, in German, Gans, Gänse, that kind of thing, it's exactly the same process that's going on. Historically, there would have been an E vowel, a high vowel, in the following syllable, and that vowel causes I mutation in contexts like the plural and in contexts like the causative. So let's have a look at Cadman's hymn again. This is the text that we saw at the start, and here I just wanted to point out some phonological features that would be important to notice in an Old English text. And when you look at your tutorial text, you can also see, if you like, whether you can find some of these features, whether you can spot the correspondences between the present-day language and the earlier language, and how they would have sounded. So here, for instance, the very first word, this is the word nu, which is now. But in modern language, we pronounce that with a diphthong. That is because of the great vowel shift, which we mentioned in the first lecture. That's much, 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 much later. Doesn't happen till the early modern period, really. This nu is our oldest, is very clearly pronounced with that back vowel, u, in Old English. So that's clear. You can forget about the great vowel shift when you're looking at texts from the Old English period. Then we have this word here, hervonriche. Now, notice that I'm pronouncing the f in the middle of the word, the letter f, I'm pronouncing it as a v, a voiced sound. This is because of what I said earlier on. In Old English, fricative voicing is allophonic, and fricatives are voiced in contexts where they are surrounded by voiced sounds. Vowels in Old English are always voiced. Voicing just means you're activating your vocal folds. So vowels are always voiced, and because there is a vowel on either side of this fricative, it gets pronounced as voiced as well. So it's heovon, not heofon. And this is the word heaven. Reach is a word that we don't really have still in English, but it's the word Reich in German, right? So this is Himmelreich. It is the kingdom of heaven, Heavenreich. So we see this process of voicing between vowels illustrating the allophonic nature of fricative voicing. And remember, what it means to be a phoneme is that you are a sound that Old English speakers would actually have recognized, have seen as a distinct sound. And those are the ones that typically are represented in writing systems. So the writing system here doesn't represent the fact that this is voiced. It's not written as voiced, it just must have been voiced anyway. We also see alliteration. We see, for instance, in the third line, we see a lot of wuz. So here we've got werk wulderfader, and then wundera in the second half line. This is not the segmental phonology of the language, but this is how Old English poetry was written. Old English poetry was alliterative. Most of the older poems are like this. Beowulf is like this too. You can see it throughout. So you can see it in the previous line as well, with m. Metodus michte, and his mordethonk. And then below, we've got one with h. So we've got heovon te hrove. Halig. So we've got hus forming the alliteration. In the final line as well, we've got f, firum folden, freer. So lots of fs. Again, it's not important that you actually understand what this says. What's important is that you see how the pronunciation relates to the spelling at this stage. So that's alliteration. We can also see examples of breaking, of the process of breaking that we talked about earlier on. So for instance, the word earth, the vowel e has become an eo, a diphthong. So we've got earth. And this is a word, this is cognate, it's directly related to the word erde in German. So again, earth. So erden bernum. Similarly, the word heaven, here we have a case of breaking as well, actually, because it's not hevon, it's heovon. So we see breaking in this text. And this is interesting because this is an early text, but having said that, this particular version of the text is actually a West Saxon version, so it's a later West Saxon version. Yes, good question. So the question is, when you look at Eordan, you've got breaking before an R. When you've got Harlig, you see Harlig and not, for instance, Herlig with breaking. And the question is, why would that be? Why do we not get breaking in this context? Well, the answer is, if we look at the specification of how breaking works, first of all, breaking actually doesn't... There are actually two reasons. The first is that breaking doesn't affect all vowels, right? It doesn't affect the back a. So back a would have been unaffected by the breaking anyway. Secondly, the context for breaking, at least the prototypical context for breaking, is one in which you've got not just the L and the R, but also another consonant following it. Here in Eald, you've got an L, but you've also got a D following it. So you need L or an R. So these sounds are called liquids, the L and the R. That's the term for these sounds, liquids, followed by another consonant, and that's what triggers breaking. So it's a very, very good question. And the answer is that breaking, the sound change, simply doesn't affect that particular context, even though at first glance it looks like it should, perhaps. Okay, so we've done, all of the talking about Old English phonology that we're going to do in the lecture context. And in the last half hour, I'm going to talk to you about the morphology of the language specifically. Now, I'm using the term grammar broadly to refer to the morphology, but also the syntax. We're not going to get to the syntax until next time round. So next week, you will get to hear about the syntax. Today, we're going to talk about the morphology. Now, Old English, and this ties into one of our grand themes, Old English is a relatively synthetic language. Both relatively and synthetic are important here. It's not the most synthetic language in the world, but it does seem to have a lot of synthetic features. So, for instance, it has four or five cases. It's got a nominative case, an accusative case, a genitive case, and a dative case, just like German. And it also has the remains of what's called an instrumental case that you use for instruments specifically. Not just musical instruments, I mean also like tools and things. They don't talk about musical instruments all that much, but they do talk about swords and axes. And those things, yes, you use the instrumental case. There is also no obligatory subject. There is no obligatory definite article in Old English. And the word order is more flexible than it is today. So those are the syntactic features that we're going to talk more about next time round. Today we're going to talk about the morphology of the language. I'm going to show you a bunch of paradigms, big tables with lots of endings in them. I do not want you to memorize these things. It would be good if you could use them, if you could understand the structure of these paradigms, but you definitely don't need to remember all of this detail for Old English in this course. The point is to understand the overall structure, and if you need to look up a word form, you will at least know how to look it up. You might have some idea what you're looking at. And if you want to find out more about Old English morphology and syntax, there are loads of good resources. So there's an introductory textbook by Hogg and Alcorn that is and it gives an overview of Old English, actually all aspects of Old English. If you're looking for something a bit more meaty, so if you're looking for something that's really, really detailed, then this book by Hogg and Fulk from 2011 gives you far more information than you ever wanted to know about the morphology of Old English. And somewhere in the middle is this book by Ringe and Taylor. It's not quite as nitty-gritty and detailed, for instance, as Hogg and Fulk, but it gives you much more detail than Hogg and Alcorn. So these are really three different sort of levels of, depending on what you want. If you want to go and look something up that's happening in Old English, you can choose between these resources. Here's an illustration of some of these morphological and syntactic properties. So first of all, here we've got verb second word order in the first clause. So the verb comes second. I'll be talking about that next time. So we've got then gave the kings. Note this plural ending, this as plural ending. Ooh, one of those ands has... that's wrong. That should be one of those Tyronean ets that we talked about earlier on. That managed to escape me. Sorry about that. So then gave the kings Cunegils and Oswald. And here we've got some dative. So we've got tham halran birine. So this is actually very close to German in some ways. So this tham, you can think of it as dem, right? So tham halran is dem heiligen, dative case, and an adjective, a weak adjective. And then you also have dative endings on nouns. So this e ending, Bischofstuhl, this is like a Bischofstuhl, right? It's the seat of a bishop. It doesn't literally refer to a chair, it refers to the place where the bishop is. The place where the bishop is, they're giving this guy the city of Dorchester, which is described as a Burg, which is like German Burg. So many times, when Old English differs from Modern English, it differs in the direction of German, which is useful for you. But what's really useful for you and what you need to know is how to spot these little endings, like the E ending and the separate dative case that we have in Old English that has been lost in the present day language. So these things are crucial, and it's the morphology I'm going to talk about now. In the nominal context, the first thing to note is that the personal pronoun system looks quite complicated. So here we've got the pronoun system of Old English. We actually see, I think again, what will strike you if you look at this pronominal system is just how German it looks in many, many ways. So we start off with first person singular, ich, and then we've got, in the accusative, we've got this, mich, basically. Then we've got this me, which corresponds more or less to mir, and then mein at the end corresponding to mein. And the same thing holds in the second person. If you think of this th as being like a d in German, you've got thu for du, you've got fetch for dich, you've got the for dir, and you've got thien for dein. Right? So it all fits together very neatly here. So those are the first and second person. In the third person, it looks a bit different, but the third person isn't actually all that different from the present day language. So we've got he, him, his, basically. He, him, his. We've also got in the accusative this form hine in the accusative, which is a bit like ihn in German. Now, then when you look at the neuter, that again is very unproblematic. It looks like it, and just like it in modern day English, it in Old English, it's pronounced hit. It's got a h on the front, and it doesn't really inflect for case. So it doesn't matter if it's the nominative or the accusative or the dative. Already, it's completely neutral with regard to these alternatives. And then we've got the genitive his for the neuter. In the feminine, now this does look different, because in modern English we have the form she, right, for feminine. She and her. The she form is not found in Old English. So then if you look here, what we have instead is he'll. We have this he'll form, and that is what gives us the feminine singular. And that in the accusative as well, here, he, rather than her. The form that ends up becoming her is this one up here, here, which is a bit also, you can see the similarities with something like ihr, ihre in German. Then we have something interesting. We have something that Old English has that modern German doesn't have, which is the dual. And the dual I've put in a slightly different colour. The dual is a form that you use to refer to exactly two people. There is wit, which is us two, basically, first person dual, and there is yit, with palatalization, and this yit means you two people. And it has forms in the accusative and dative and in the genitive as well. Unk, unker, ink, inker. So this is when they're referring to two people specifically. This is actually a case that you shouldn't really need to worry about too much, because you don't actually see it very often. In the Old English period, it's already being lost. And what happens is that towards the end of the Old English period, people just start using the plural instead. So they don't actually use this separate form, this dual form. And then we've got first and second person plural, which are, again, not complicated, not problematic. We, us, ur, which is like our, not too hard. Second person plural, ye, ye, and then we've got eo, which is spelt differently, but if you think about how it sounds, eo, eo, it's you, you. So eo is the you form, and eoer is your, and so ultimately this pronoun system, although there are a lot of different forms in it, it doesn't look hugely different from the present-day language, with a few exceptions, particularly third-person feminine singular in the nominative, this he'll form, rather than she, and then finally the bottom line. Right? And the bottom line, we don't get any he, we don't get they, them, there, we get here, him, here. So the forms with th, they come in later, and we'll get to that later in the course. So the TH third-person plural forms are a later development in the history of English. So here we have some uses of pronouns that you can see. So here we have an example from Beowulf, Fatvetch, that you, dich, essentially, drichtguma, death oversweedeth, that you, the mighty ruler, death overpowers. So already you can see that the word order is different. But you can see a second-person pronoun here. That's the point. Here, we've got, what's interestingly, we've got here, it says, then hid Adam him. He didn't hide himself, he hid him. And that is a very striking feature of Old English. It doesn't have reflexive pronouns at all. It uses normal pronouns, where in the present-day language you can only use reflexive pronouns. So we would have to say, he hid himself, or just, he hid. But in Old English they would say, he hid him. And Adam and him are co-referential here. They refer to the same person, Adam. We also, of course, find a great deal of spelling variation in the Old English period. This is long before standardization, so the variation is huge. We also find demonstratives. We find inflecting demonstratives in Old English texts. This is something very different from present-day English, because in English now, the articles and the demonstratives don't inflect at all. Again, if you look at this form, you ought to be able to spot, at least forms, you ought to be able to spot certain similarities with present-day German. So, for instance, the forms with tham are forms like dem in German. The forms with thare are often the forms with der in German. The forms with thas are often the forms with des at least in the formal genitive in German. So those forms in particular are quite reminiscent of the system in a language like German. Similarly, in the masculine, you can see thonne, which is like den in the accusative singular. So the system of demonstratives works very much along the same lines as the system of demonstratives or definite articles in present-day German. And these demonstratives are actually very useful for distinguishing the cases of nominal phrases. I should also note that it's already the case that just like in German, these forms can also work, they don't have to be pure demonstratives, they can also function as definite articles. They refer to something that is in the context, that is familiar, and that is unique. That's what the definite article does in these languages. Nouns, now this is where the system really differs from present-day English. Nouns have grammatical gender and they inflect for case. So here are various different ways of forming nouns in Old English. You've got boat, the noun boat, which is bat, and you can see there's a nominative form, which is the same as the accusative form, bat, but there is also a dative form, bate, and a genitive form, bates. And depending on the case and the number and the gender, the noun will take a different form. So this is one of the factors that we mean when we talk about Old English being a relatively synthetic language. The nouns have many different forms, and actually a lot of these forms are made up of multiple, at least two morphemes. The nouns that I've shown you here are what's called strong nouns. These aren't all of the noun classes that you get in Old English, but like I say, I don't want you to memorize the paradigms. What I want you to do is recognize these facts, to recognize the fact that these nouns have different forms according to gender, number, and case. And that you will need to be able to do for the exam. You will be given the paradigms in the exam, but you will be expected to use them to figure out certain things about the forms that you will see. I will come back and give you a bit more of a primer on what exactly I expect from you in the exam at a later date in the course. But it's crucial that you simply recognize that these nouns can take different forms. Unlike in modern English, where everything really only has one singular form and one plural form, and where there is no gender. And the gender is important. The gender works in the same way as it does in German. So a boat is masculine and a ship is neuter. Why? Don't ask me, it just is, right? Why is it das Boot in German, right? Right. A boat is neuter in German. Why? I don't know. A bus is masculine, der Bus, right? Again, okay. These are arbitrary facts about individual languages. Gender, just like in present-day German, is essentially an arbitrary lexical class property in Old English. And then finally, again, just like in German, adjectives inflect. They get strong endings, they get weak endings, and they get their endings based on the context. If the gender and the case and the number of the noun is a certain way, then the adjective will agree with it. So, again, this is the adjective gord, meaning good. And here, these adjectives clearly have different forms depending on what the noun is that they are modifying. So, for instance, if you're modifying a dative noun, you will often find the ending, as in gud at least if it's masculine or neuter, or if it's in the plural, you will find this ending. And the endings vary depending on the context. Unlike nouns, adjectives get their endings from context. So nouns mostly get their endings from their inherent properties. If you're talking about two boats, well, the word boat is inherently masculine in Old English. The number is given by the semantics. You're talking about more than one. And the case is given by the semantics as well. Whereas in a case, if you modify it with an adjective to green boats or something, the adjective green simply gets its gender, its case, and its number properties from the noun that it modifies. So those are the adjectives. Here are some noun phrases that you can play around with in your own time if you like. There are many, many useful resources online for the morphology of Old English, because believe me, the morphology of Old English is the hardest part of the language. So if you want to check things out, first of all, there's an online dictionary here you can use to look up words. You can look up, for instance, things like the gender of words there. Here is a translation of Beowulf if you want it. And here is perhaps the most important thing of all, which is a single page that contains all of the morphological paradigms that you will ever need for Old English. All right, so that's the nominal morphology. What can we say about the verbal morphology then? Well, first of all, just like with the nouns, there is an awful lot more verbal morphology than there is in the present day language. So endings on verbs depend on various things. It has a lot more subject-verb agreement. So just like modern English, it has tense marking, past and non-past, only two tenses. But it also has person and number marking that is quite rich, that you have to be aware of. Similarly, you also have mood. So there is a subjunctive mood in Old English. We don't really have a subjunctive in present-day English. But there is one in Old English, and the endings on the verbs depend on what mood the verb is in. Subjunctive mood, broadly speaking, is used to express unreal, hypothetical-type situations. But it's a little bit complicated trying to determine where exactly you do and don't get subjunctive morphology in Old English. The verbal system, and I keep saying this with Old English morphology, the verbal system of Old English looks quite similar to modern German. Not actually with regard to the distribution of the subjunctive, that's different, but the way the verbal system works in Old English is actually very, very similar to what we find in modern German. The only major difference is that the prefix that's spelt G-E, the German ge prefix, which in Old English, because of palatalization, is pronounced ye, so the ye prefix. In Old English, this is very, in German, this is very straightforward. You use it for past participles. In Old English, it's a little bit more complicated. It tends to crop up in other places as well. So you can't rely on this prefix to tell you that you're dealing with a past participle. Finally, then, verbs divide up into strong and weak. The strong verbs are the ones that change the stem vowels in the past tense and in their past participle. So these are verbs like, in modern English, sing, sang, sung. The weak verbs are the ones that form the past tense using this dental preterite that we discussed last week. So play, played, played, right, with a d. Keep, kept, with a t. These dental preterite forms, those are the ones that are the weak verbs, and the strong verbs have the vowel alternations. And we find over the history of English that many of the strong verbs become weak, but we'll get onto that later. So here's what a strong verb looks like in a paradigm. So this is the verb driven, to drive. And you can see that drive, the crucial thing to note, first of all, you should note that there are lots of different endings. So ich drive, du drivest. So this verb is directly cognate with treiben in German. Ich treibe, du treibst. Or hit driveth, so er treibt. And then the plural forms are all the same in German. And the past tense, similar. But the past tense, because this is a strong verb, what we see is the vowel changing. So we get not a form of the stem drief, but instead draf, right, with an a. So you've got an e and a alternation. You also have a short vowel in some of these forms, like I here, driven. Right? Just like in the present day language, we have drive versus driven. He has driven the car. The weak verbs, on the other hand, the endings look very similar, if not identical, but what differs is this dental preterite. So if you focus in on what goes on in the past tense, in the bottom part of this table, rather than finding a vowel changing in the stem, like we did in the previous slide, you find this de. So this is the verb fremman, to do or to perform. And this is, this in its past tense, just takes a de ending. And the de ending is what tells you that you're dealing with the past. It's also what tells you that you're dealing with a weak verb rather than a strong verb. One thing to bear in mind is that there is another kind of verb in English, the verb to be, which is only one verb. There's only one verb that behaves like this, the verb to be, and it's very special, and it behaves, it has all kinds of weird oddities. Here I'm only presenting it because it's the verb that you will encounter the most often. It's the most common verb, and so you will be able to hopefully recognize some of these forms. And again, some of them look distinctly German-like. So, for instance, "Thu bist," right? This is not something that we see in the present-day English language, but it does look a lot like German. Similarly, these forms, "we sind on," "we sind," "wir sind," right? These forms are lost in English later on, but they're retained in the Old English period. But that, I think, is really all we have time for in terms of the verbs. Here you can see a little discussion, which I've rendered in SMS form. This is actually an Old English text, and you can have a look at this in your own time if you like. Here's our summary. So I've talked today about the sources, I've talked about the spelling, I've talked about the pronunciation, and I've talked about the morphology. Next time, we will be talking about the syntax, we'll be talking about the lexicon, so the actual stock of words in this language, and we'll also be talking about the dialectal variation in the language. So what I want you to do for the tutorial, there's a couple of exercises, but please also look at the Genesis text in Ilias, and try and identify the words. I want you to try and figure out what these words are, what they're doing there. And that is your task for the tutorial this week. But that is it for today. I'll see you next time.